And this is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
We speak with Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as coordinator of the program in Middle East Studies. Dr. Zunis is one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action. Dr. Zunis joins us from Sudan. Dr. Zunis, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Great to be with you.
Dr. Zunis, in July of this year, you criticized the Trump administration's threats towards Iran, saying that by treating the Iranian regime as a monolith, it risked, at that juncture just, closing one of the few remaining avenues for diffusing crisis. Now, to add insult to injury, Trump ordered what I consider to be the extrajudicial murder of Major General Qassem Soleimani. How do you assess, really, the political harm? Where are we, and what has this latest action, this murder, what does it portend for the relationship between Iran and the U.S.?
Oh, just as one thought, it couldn't get worse. The United States breaking off the nuclear agreement that had been negotiated by seven different countries under the auspices of the United Nations, the imposing of these draconian sanctions that were not only harmful to the Iranian people in terms of their impact, but it was not just the United States that imposed these sanctions. It, because the United States promised to punish other countries and other companies that didn't include sanctions as well, it ended up being quite comprehensive. And the moderates of the regime, like Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, whom I met with in Tehran, back in March, you know, he was saying he was being battled by the hardliners because he convinced them they are very reluctant to sign the nuclear agreement. They're saying we can't trust the United States. We said, yes, you can trust the United States. We can, and signing this, we have to give up our nuclear program, which I know is our right, but we'll have to give up most aspects of it. I mean, destroying a $2 billion reactor that was almost complete, destroying thousands of centrifuges, giving up the uranium stockpile. I mean, again, didn't eliminate their program altogether, but certainly about 97% of it. And in return, these sanctions will end, and we can be a normal nation. And lo and behold, Trump proved the hardliners right, that you couldn't trust the United States, and that's what's precipitated the crisis. But now, more recently, we've had this thing coming up where Trump starts insisting that the Iranians are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Americans. And what's shocking is that even the mainstream media and many Democratic politicians, even those who oppose Soleimani's assassination, are just repeating this as fact. But, you know, I looked it up, and I actually did an article for the Institute for Policy Studies back in 2007 when these charges were first raised by the Bush administration. Now, remember, this is the same administration that falsely claimed that Iraq had these vast stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons, that had a nuclear weapons program, that had these sophisticated delivery systems, et cetera, et cetera. In 2007, they started saying, oh, Iran is killing Americans. Well, I looked into detail at the time, and there really wasn't any evidence. They claimed that these explosives, these IEDs, roadside bombs were Iranian origin, but they never gave any proof that that was the case. And they claimed, oh, they were too sophisticated for the Iraqis to make, so it has to be Iranian. But then you start to think, well, wait a minute. If Iraq's so sophisticated that they could be on the verge of developing an atomic bomb and these long-range missiles, why can't they figure out how to build these roadside bombs? It seemed to be pretty groundless, and people had pretty much forgotten it. But then Trump revives this 12-year-old myth, and all of a sudden the mainstream media and leading Democrats are sort of taking this at face value. Well, even if it was true, the Iranians were responsible for hundreds of American deaths back during the 12, 14 years ago, still doesn't give the United States the justification of assassinating an Iranian general, especially one who had arrived in Baghdad reportedly to speak at the invitation of the Iraqi prime minister to try to figure out a way of diffusing tensions with the United States. But I wanted to bring this out right up front at the beginning of our conversation because, I'm really disappointed more people haven't pointed out that that these claims are, in fact, completely or appear to be completely false. Again, I can't rule it out 100%, but, that they certainly have not produced any evidence, and I'm disappointed we haven't had more people in the media and the Democratic Party going to Trump saying, hey, if they're really killing hundreds of Americans, where's the evidence?
Additionally, how has the U.S. militarism, an outright act of war, actually affected pro-democracy forces in Iran?
It's huge. I mean, you had these major demonstrations in recent week. You know, I when I visited Iran in February and March of this year, you know, the people are really disgusted with the regime. It's a reactionary regime. It's an authoritarian regime. It's a corrupt regime. People are just really, really fed up. But at the same time, you know, they also opposed U.S. policy. I mean, I didn't hear any support for Donald Trump or anything like that there. It's clear that the Islamic Republic has lost its mandate with the people, and they're really eager for change. But what has happened with this attack, this assassination, the Iranian people have rallied around the flag, and even the dissidents are falling in line because they see this, you know, correctly as an act of aggression, an act of war. And the thing about Iranians, a lot of people forget, is that we social scientists actually try to do measures of these kind of things, like degree of national pride, patriotism, national identity, whatever. Iranians are about the most nationalistic people in the world, literally. And, you know, there's a great pride in their country. They don't like being pushed around like they're a banana republic. You know, as much as they may despise the clerical leadership, as much as they may want social change, they want to be treated with respect. And this the attitude the United States has done has just aggravated this. I mean, if we go back to Vietnam, our big mistake in Vietnam was we saw the movement as communism, part of the international communist expansion. And the way to fight international communism is, or any kind of global totalitarian ideology, is through massive military force. And what we missed the fact was, yes, it was a Marxist-Leninist movement, but it was first and foremost a nationalist movement. And so he wondered why it was that the more we bombed, the more troops we sent in, the more the resistance. And this is a similar thing we're in Iran. We see the hardline reactionary Islamist leadership, but we forget that much of their power comes from their ability to manipulate the strong nationalist sentiments that Iranians across the political and ideological and theological spectrum believe in. And so, you know, this kind of American military action and threats and assassinations, again, that's just strengthening the regime and weakening the pro-democracy forces. And let me quickly add that in Iraq, you also have had an even bigger, more widespread movement that was challenging the corrupt Iraqi government there, too. This U.S. attack has brought people to rally around the flag. It happened on Iraqi soil, it's led to this demand that's largely successful, or the parliament, at least, has said, U.S. forces need to get out. Again, it was very, very counterproductive for the U.S. if they wanted to maintain a presence in Iraq, but it's also been very counterproductive, again, for the pro-democracy Iraqis who were, had this mass movement that's been going on for a couple months, and again, it's all halted now as people are out protesting the United States.
Professor Zunis, you've begun to characterize the regime as a whole, the Iranian regime. How do you look at and understand the role, and what can you tell us about actually the significance of General Soleimani for the Iranian people and the role that he was playing in the region?
Well, he was fairly popular, at least among some sectors. I mean, as someone who represented the reassertion of Iranian power and influence in the region, head of the Al-Quds Force, which is the a branch of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the largest wing of the Iranian armed forces, and he was active in supporting pro-Iranian militia and others in various parts of the Middle East, including Iraq, where they are highly influential. The crisis began when the U.S. ended up bombing a southern site of the Hatif Hezbollah militia group, which is nominally a branch of the Iraqi army, though they had very, very close ties to Iran, and then Soleimani is effectively the leader. And what these and other militia did, and under Soleimani's leadership, is they were the most effective fighting force against ISIS and defeating them largely. I mean, they're still there, but at least in terms of territorial control, they've been largely eliminated in northern Iraq and parts of Syria. I mean, I should quickly add, they're pretty ruthless in how they did it. They ended up jailing and torturing and killing prisoners and other suspects, some of whom were not, in fact, ISIS. In fact, I should emphasize that Soleimani was pretty bad news, pretty ruthless character. Indeed, some of his forces were responsible for killing many of the pro-democracy protesters in Iraq. And so one can certainly make a case that Soleimani's role in Iraq and Iran's role in Iraq in general it has not been a good one. They've done some damage, but of course that pales in comparison to the amount of damage that has been done by the United States as a result of the invasion and occupation of that country back in 2003. And again, we need to emphasize that if it were not for the U.S. invasion, there'd be no ISIS. ISIS is a direct outgrowth of the invasion and occupation. Similar, there'd be no Fatih Hezbollah, these pro-Iranian militia, again, are a result of the U.S. invasion. So here we are, a very predictable outcome of a war we should have never waged is now being used as an excuse to wage a new war.
You know, interesting. I'm just curious about your thoughts about, we talk about fighting proxy wars in the Middle East, and I keep thinking that in a lot of ways the U.S. relationship to Iran is one of a surrogate for the interests of Saudi Arabia and Israel. So maybe you can give us a little bit of an insight into perhaps the role of that Israel, and indeed the Saudis may have played in the U.S. militarism or stepped up ramped up militarism. And how do you understand this in any event? I mean, clearly Washington cares little about human rights violations in Iran or anywhere else in the world. So then its interest in provoking this kind of ramped up tension or war really with Iran.
Yeah, I think it has primarily, it's about old-fashioned U.S. hegemony, imperialism, frankly. I mean, this is the same kind of thing that led to the U.S. overthrowing Iran's constitutional government back in 1953 and overthrowing Mossadegh, installing the Shah, and which, of course, resulted in the Iranian Revolution. Here's another irony of the whole fact that Iran is under this reactionary Islamist rule is, again, a direct consequence of a previous U.S. intervention. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, speaking as someone, which many of your listeners who've heard me on WBAI before, know, I'm a very strong critic of Israel and the occupation. Ever since the 1970s, I've been supported the Palestinian cause. But I would caution against exaggerating Israel's role regarding U.S. policy in Iraq and towards Iran. I mean, AIPAC and like-minded groups have, certainly pushed Congress to take a hard line, and there may be a handful of otherwise, liberal Democrats who might have taken somewhat more moderate view that have endorsed more hardline views as a result of this pressure. But the overall thrust of U.S. policy towards Iran and Iraq would be the same regardless of Israel or Zionist groups or anything like that. And similarly with Saudi Arabia, their interest in curbing Iranian influence like that of Israel is strong. But it coincides with U.S. policy. Neither Saudi Arabia nor Israel are forcing the U.S. to take the hard line that it does. It is a confluence of interests. And in fact, one thing is rather striking. When I was in Iran this spring, that the Iranians seemed actually more obsessed with Saudi Arabia than they were with Israel. Indeed, I keep here in Sudan and other places I've traveled in the Middle East. I mean, people are much more concerned about Saudi Arabia's influence as an anti-democratic force, a potential interventionist force, than they are that of Iran. And it's also just important to think, as you implied in your question about the hypocrisy about human rights. I mean, almost everything you can say negative about Iran, their human rights abuses, lack of free and fair elections, suppression of women and religious minorities, the support of extremist groups. You know, while most of that is in fact true, it pales in comparison to Saudi Arabia. I mean, on every count, Saudi Arabia is worse than Iran. And so, you know, the fact that we have have Trump and others going on and on about how terrible Iran is, and while cozying up to the Saudis, I mean, it's the height of hypocrisy.
And the logic, I mean, politically, or are we just left to the whim and mercurial nature of Trump to understand what was involved and why at this juncture there would be such a forceful, virulent act, which, as far as I'm concerned, still is an act of terrorism?
Yeah, very much so. But, I mean, you're assuming it's hard to say Trump and plan or Trump and forethought or Trump and strategy in one sentence. I mean, I really do think it was an impulsive kind of act, and this kind of naive assumption that using brute force and this kind of pressure would get Iran to compromise when clear they weren't. I mean, Iran's been a major power on and off of the past. Iran, just reminding listeners, that was formerly known as Persia. Iran has been a major regional power on and off for the past 2,500 years. The U.S. is not going to be able to bully it into compliance. In fact, it's going to have the reverse reaction. So on the one hand, it's easy just to see this as another example of Trump's impetuous, short-sighted, way of doing things. I think it's important to point out that the groundwork in many ways has been bipartisan, that both Democrats and Republicans over the years have really sought to demonize Iran, cut off Iran, failed to try to engage in the kind of policies that would encourage the more moderate elements. As recent, and just a few weeks ago, the Democrats in the House, the leadership anyway, convinced the majority of Democrats to vote Republicans in voting for the Defense Authorization Act, which not only raised the obscenely high Pentagon budget to an even higher level, but they refused to include previous amendments that would have limited Trump's ability to take military action in that part of the world, and would have stopped support for Saudi Arabia's war on terror in Yemen, which is being used as an excuse as a proxy war against Iran. So I think it's the assassination of Soleimani is a very Trumpian kind of thing. I don't think even hawkish Democrats like Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton, if they were president, would have quite done that. But people like Biden and Clinton and others, and their hostility towards Iran has exhibited over the years, certainly paved the groundwork for Trump to engage in this kind of escalation.
So today, the rationales continue to be such as they are, that this was a move of self-defense, that there is imminent danger. There's been nothing concrete that has been presented to warrant that conclusion or justify it. But in your own understanding, your own analysis, your frequent trips to the area, do you have any indication whatsoever that through General Soleimani, etc., that there was going to be a more aggressive militarist posture on the part of Iran towards any of the interests of the U.S. in the region?
I think on the one hand, one could say that as a way of ramping up pressure on the United States, that Iran might have, you know, given some of its allied militia a little more of a free hand in certain kinds of operations. But this idea that there was some kind of imminent Iranian attack or attack by Iranian proxies against U.S. forces, I mean, there's absolutely no evidence to indicate that is true. I mean, the Iraqi government has categorically denied that. And again, Soleimani arrived in the Baghdad airport and was on his way to meet the prime minister when he got blown up for just the opposite reason, to try to calm things down. It's pretty clear that this imminent threat idea was a fabrication. And you know, and to the credit of at least some Democrats in Congress and some people in the mainstream media, they are actually asking hard questions along these lines. And the administration, of course, has failed to give any evidence whatsoever. Indeed, their rationale has gone through various incarnations. It's pretty clear that not only was this blatantly illegal, but again, it didn't have seemed any strategic logic. But again, as I mentioned at the outset of this interview, this idea that Iran was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Americans, I've been very disappointed at that point has not been challenged more directly, because, again, there seems to be no evidence to actually back that up either.
And as we kind of wind up here, you reference Joe Biden. Your response and your thoughts about the Democratic field of candidates, Iran, and the increased U.S. militarism, and certainly this particular incident of the murder of General Qassem Soleimani.
And Biden gave a very lukewarm response, focused about what evil guy he was, and I think failed to come, more explicit in terms of the illegality and non-necessity and danger of the operation. And both he and Buttigieg have sort of emphasized more the process that Trump failed to notify Congress, as he's required to do under the War Powers Act. And it's been much more of a process argument than addressing the more fundamental and important questions that need to be addressed. By contrast, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been much, especially Sanders, have been much more straightforward in their criticism. Sanders explicitly used the word assassination. Warren, was also very clear that this was illegal and unnecessary and would only make things worse. And it seems to be a division of hawks and doves of Buttigieg and Biden on one side and Sanders and Warren on the other that we've seen in Democratic politics on and off since 1968. And I think the one good thing that might come out of this is that I hope that foreign policy will become more of a topic in the coming Democratic debates, because we sure don't want to have Biden in there, because again, Biden is, like Clinton, is definitely in the hawkish wing of the party. I think his election as president would be very, very dangerous. In fact, it would, as with Clinton's support or hawkish views and support for the Iraq War, Trump paradoxically could again campaign on the left as he did against Clinton and win over a lot of votes of more isolationist libertarian type centrists that might otherwise vote Democratic. Not to mention, we've seen a lot of data that shows that the counties that went most dramatically from Obama in 2012 and 2008 to Trump in 2016 parallel almost exactly the counties with the highest casualty rates from Iraq and Afghanistan, indicative that Trump's anti-war perspectives were and Clinton's hawkishness was a factor in her defeat, especially since these counties were concentrated in places like Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. That proved to be decisive in Trump's Electoral College victory. So I would argue that not only for the obvious principled reasons we need to get someone like Warren and Sanders in, but also for the chances of a Democratic victory, I think much more electable on foreign policy, because Americans, it's not just the left that are anti-interventionists or are skeptical of these overseas wars. We're seeing it more and more across the political spectrum, and it's important that the Democrats stop being so darn wimpy and start taking much more decisive anti-war positions.
Well, Dr. Zunis, thank you for spending some time with us. And wow, we have a wonderful clear line. I was a bit surprised. And I'm saying that by way of, again, mentioning that you happen to be in Sudan, and I know that you've been doing enormous work with an analysis of the pro-democracy movement that erupted in Sudan, or reappeared, perhaps, and garnered tremendous
force. Mention it. Yeah, just to mention briefly in closing that being here in Sudan is just amazing the way that these many women in leadership were able to bring down the 30-year al-Bashir regime, one of the most brutal, misogynistic, and oppressive governments on the planet. And I think it's a reminder, if you want to promote democracy in the Middle East, you don't do it through foreign invasion. You leave it to the people to do it themselves. And the irony is that while the United States is so strongly supporting governments like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the Emirates and Bahrain, all these other dictatorships, that the United States still has sanctions against Sudan, which is really hurting them economically, making it very difficult to attract foreign investment or other support. I mean, it says more than anything that the United States is not particularly interested in democracy. Otherwise, they would be cheering on and supporting the Democratic Sudanese Revolution instead of trying to isolate it.
Well, you've just given me the moment to invite you back next week to spend as much time with us to talk about what has been happening in Sudan. I hope you accept that invitation.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd enjoy that.
Well, again, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunis, who, as I indicated, and I think you heard, is one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and strategic nonviolent action. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.